It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. And in today's conversation, we're really going to be talking about the history of the current epoch, which is the Anthropocene. And I'll leave that to our guest in a little bit to help us understand that term and what that means and why we should even care about our rivers and streams. We know they're important to us. And so we're going to provide a starting point that really is going to be a series that Krista and I are going to do over the coming year about water and the ways in which humans have had an impact on our water and how we can restore, repair, and protect our rivers.
Thanks, Mark. I'm Dr. Krista Longton, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at IUPUI and Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the IU School of Medicine. And I'm really excited to welcome our guest today, Dr. Jason M. Kelly, who is the Director of the IUPUI Arts and Humanities Institute and Chair and Professor of History in the Indiana University School of Liberal Arts at IUPUI. He is also an adjunct professor of Africana Studies and American Studies. Thanks so much for being with us today, Jason.
Thanks for having me. It's great to see both of you.
You too. You know, Jason, I think we really need to start, and this is why I chose you, really about the idea of why we are concerned and thinking about this word, this term, Anthropocene. Can you unpack that a little bit for us? I know that's where you've got some writings and expertise in that area.
Sure. Yeah. The Anthropocene is, as I like to say, both a concept and a lived experience. So if you think of it, it's a kind of an intellectual thing we talk about. And then people also live through this thing we talk about. So sometimes it's best to separate those two things out as we get started. So I'm going to start talking about the concept first. So the Anthropocene was an idea that geologists and earth system scientists started throwing around maybe about 20 years ago or so. They started popularizing it. And the idea was simply this, that in the past, when we've had major changes to the planet, we can measure these things. Geologists have measured them. We can look at the stratigraphic layers in the planet and trace that back billions of years. When you see changes, you can measure those changes, and sometimes those are environmental changes, sometimes those are changes to the flora and fauna on the planet, but you can measure these things out. The geologists began looking at how humans have transformed the planet over the past 250 years in particular. That's really where they started. And they've seen such a dramatic change that they proposed this idea that maybe we've entered a new geological age, and that we could measure that age by looking at the stratigraphy, that those layers in the Earth's crust. And they proposed that humans had become one of the Earth's greatest forces. So when you think of Earth's forces, right, you think of things like water moving sediment across the planet. You think of tectonic plates. You think of these grand transformations of the planet. But they're making the argument that maybe humans have actually become one of these forces, so much so that we've left this layer in the planet, and that if we were to disappear tomorrow, alien archaeologists could show up 10,000 years from now, and they could measure the human's impact on the planet. And this is where the Anthropocene comes from. The Anthropos, which is the human, and seen means new. So the human age effectively is this new age that they're proposing. And so around 2007 or so, scientists began seriously investigating whether we should name this new epoch the Anthropocene.
Wow.
Can I ask a follow-up question to that?
Yeah.
As a communication scholar, of course, a lot of my questions are often about sort of thinking about the language, how language shapes us. If we kind of zoom out, why is it important to name this age?
I'll go back to the original paper that was written that proposed, they asked the question actually, are we living in the Anthropocene? So there was two reasons that they proposed. One was a geological reason, right? So would it be accurate? Would it be more accurate to say that we've entered this human age? Would that be geological accurate? And there's lots of questions that emerge from that. Like, what is the indicator that we're going to look at? Is it going to be nuclear radiation from nuclear tests since 1945? And that's actually a reasonable indicator to me. Is it going to be the amount of nitrogen that humans have put into the Earth's ecosystems since they began fixing nitrogen artificially in the early 20th century, roughly? Is it the coal burning, right? Is it the changes to the climate itself? Is it the amount of carbon? Is it the temperature changes that we? There's lots of different indicators that are global indicators, and so that's the first question. You know, is there something we can measure? The second question was, I would argue, more of a moral question. And it comes down to the question of, if humans have made changes to the planet, by calling it out, that adds a layer of responsibility to all humans on the planet. And we can get to this a little bit later, but not all humans are either contributing equally or experiencing the Anthropocene equally. But there's a moral element of this, right? So if we measure it, then we also have to say, well, you've created this thing and you're responsible for dealing with the consequences of that and maybe mitigating the worst effects of what you've done. So that second part is often forgotten in popular conversations about the Anthropocene, but it was there from the very beginning and it underlies a lot of environmental conversations as well.
You know, there's an old concept, Jason, that was a part of the beginnings of some of that thought about humans and having an impact on it. And that was that tragedy of the commons. In fact, there was even a book written around that about how humans didn't seem to understand how to use the common resource in a productive way. And it sounds like a little bit of what you're saying is that we're actually got a record, a geologic record of us not being able to handle our commons.
Yeah, the commons is a really interesting question, Mark. I'm glad you brought the tragedy of the commons up. Listeners may know that one of the great writers on the commons was an IU professor, Eleanor Ostrom, right? So she was very important in thinking about what common pool resources are and how humans manage those at multiple levels, right? You manage them sometimes at the local level, sometimes you manage them at the state level, sometimes you manage them at the global level, depending on what kinds of common pool resources you're talking about. But the article that a lot of people go back to is Garrett Hardin's article, right? The Tragedy of the Commons. And, you know, in some way, it's a really interesting article to think with, but it's also an extremely problematic article. In many ways, it's ahistorical. Garrett Hardin imagines a commons, right? Where people are driven by pure greed, effectively. They're driven by their desire to get as much for themselves as possible. But what we know from historical commons is that that's not actually how those commons were managed. Land, quote unquote, held in common was often very closely managed and well managed by communities of people that came together and did create a structure for using those commons. So there are certainly many, many, many examples of people managing commons well. But the bigger issue there is also important, right? So if we are living in a world where people are extracting for individual gain, then we do throw these ecosystems out of whack. you know, this could happen at the local level, and that's problematic. And we've all seen how that happens in different places. But when we extract at the global levels, when humans become an Earth systems force, then that gets so out of control that it can throw off all of the other Earth systems. And maybe I should define what I mean by Earth systems. So when we're talking about Earth systems, we're talking about the carbon cycle, the water cycle, the nitrogen cycle, how these elements and substances flow across the planet and maintain a kind of a steady state that allows life to survive.
One of the things that is interesting to me, whether you're talking about the concept of the commons, something that is probably not as familiar maybe to folks outside academic circles as you know, is familiar to many of us, or even talk about the Anthropocene, it does for me go back to that initial question about why we would need to name this age in the first place, because it gives us a common language to talk about, right? So, you know, when I think about my family members who don't have college degrees and, you know, who drive cars and do all of the things that, you know, impact the human experience and live in the United States, right? So have resources beyond what, you know, many of those outside the United States have. I think that for me, like just having language to talk about these concepts gives us a starting point to be able to address some of the kind of moral issues that you bring up there, Jason.
Yeah, and that is so important. I agree 100% with that. Yes, we always need that common language. Mark and I were at a conference. What was this? 2014. We did the Rivers of the Anthropocene conference here, and that was actually one of the things on the first day of our workshop that went with the common went with the conference that we talked about, was actually finding a common language. And this was mostly scholars and artists and policymaker type folks who already imagined they had a common language. But in fact, when you put everybody in a room, we may even be using the same words, but we mean different things when we use them. So your point about a common language, a place to start from, whether you like the Anthropocene or not, it is a great place to start from.
Yeah, and I think it puts forward the idea that there is a human element. Yeah. And, you know, when we think about it, we can go back and historically through also in science and other things, pre-human, everything creates waste. Everything has, you know, nature has to have mechanisms to clean up. There are terrible catastrophes that happen with volcanoes and earthquakes and other things. But there's something that happened, and I don't know if you can speak to that a little bit, but it seems like there's something that happened when we discovered fossil fuels that sort of took us a little bit away from nature's ability to handle what we were creating.
Yeah. Yeah, there's this big debate about the Anthropocene, which I'm sure you're both familiar with. And it's a debate about dating. Mm-hmm. At what point did humans become this big force, right? And right. Initially, the geologists put forward 250 years ago because of the coal, because burning fossil fuels was such an important moment in modern history. As a person who studies 300 years ago, I consider everything 300 or 250 years ago modern history. But there are other dates we could have given, right? We could have talked about megafaunal extinctions, you know, tens of thousands of years ago. You know, some have argued that the European contact in the Americas and the in the century that followed the death caused by war and disease. That actually was a moment in history where there was a major change that took place. So there's lots of different things. Geologists have to point to data, right? So that becomes an interesting thing, right? A geologist, if you're going to make an argument for a global change, you actually need data on a global level.
Right.
So when we talk about megafaunal extinctions, for example, we're not even sure to what extent they were anthropogenic. And by anthropogenic, we mean human caused, right? So And even if they were all anthropogenic, all 100% anthropogenic, that happened over long periods of tens of thousands of years of time. So there are some arguments for that being a good date for the Anthropocene, and there are some arguments against it. What we can talk about, though, from a data side, is the culmination of coal burning has thrown off the thermal gauge of the planet, right? We are seeing CO2 parts per million roughly doubled, more than doubled, in the last 150 years or so. And that's caused by fossil fuel burning. There's no other reason why we see this. And we've seen a concurrent increase in temperatures on the planet. And that's why, Mark, to your point, that coal, the beginnings of the use of fossil fuels are such a good indicator, because we can measure it. We can see it in lots of different places around the globe. And that's why we often talk about fossil fuel burning. I tend to take a slightly different approach. I'd be happy to talk about that a little bit more with you. But while geologists have to focus on the product, the consequence of this, as a historian, we tend to focus on the process. And so I tend to think of the Anthropocene as a process, not a product, right? It is all of those human and nature interactions that have actually taken place over hundreds of years that are the process of the Anthropocene that have gotten us to this point here where there are measurable effects of that. And so I think it has to be this combination of measuring the effects, but also understanding the processes.
Yeah, what's fascinating to me, Jason, and what you're saying, and you used that word, a moral, kind of a moral imperative, is it's, I think, difficult for people when we apply, and I'm not sure what the psychology is, and I'm not asking you to be able to answer that, but when we point the finger at ourselves as a community, right, humans, there seems to be a lining up of sometimes, yes, absolutely we're at fault. And then there's this whole other thing, well, there's no way you're going to point that finger at me kind of thing. And that gets into the morals of that, right? I mean, it gets into what you're talking about and why we have to name it.
Yeah. When we think of something maybe a little bit more simple, maybe pollution would be a good example of this, like air pollution in your city. Did you cause the air pollution? Well, maybe not. But are you all breathing that air pollution? Yes, you're all breathing the air pollution. So everybody's affected by this thing. So do you have a responsibility to act to maybe, if you don't care about yourself, what about your family members? What about your friends? What kind of action are you going to take in this local environment where you're all breathing in the same thing? On a global all we're doing is scaling up from the local, right? So if this is a global change, and we do know there is global climate change, and we're all breathing it, right, as it were, then do we all have a responsibility to each other? And this gets to Krista's point about naming the thing, right? The Anthropocene, where we're all, agents in this. And it gets to that moral piece of it, which is, do you have an obligation to your neighbor, whether they're next door or whether they live 10,000 miles away? And the Anthropocene is really, I think, in the best of ways, asking those questions. It's also, and this can be the challenging piece for some folks, the Anthropocene was neither created, nor is it experienced equally across the globe. We do know that some countries historically, and these are European and North American countries primarily, who have produced most of the CO2 outputs over the last several hundred years. They're not the only ones producing that amount now, but they have increased the amount of CO2 parts per million over this long period of time. They were actively causing this change to happen. Whether they knew it or not, they were changing the climate system. Well, for folks who Maybe we're living in a country that didn't produce as much CO2. They may not historically have been as responsible for this, but unfortunately, they may be experiencing the worst effects of it. So if you think of maybe a Pacific Island nation where you have rising sea levels and entire countries are being threatened by these rising sea levels, you know, these small island countries may not have produced huge amounts of CO2, but they are affecting it. It's an, what I call an asymmetric Anthropocene. It's created asymmetrically and it's experienced asymmetrically.
That's great. That really helps. Krista?
Yeah, so I'm thinking about, you know, as you're talking, Jason, I'm thinking about the ways in which, and maybe we can just go down this sort of agency piece that you mentioned here, right? The idea that, okay, if we agree that this is the language that we're going to use to talk about the human impact that we have and that we've got some common language to do that. And the notion that these effects are, as you said, sort of levied asymmetrically, I think then it gets us, at least for me, as we're talking, to a conversation about equity, right? To a conversation about not, you know, again, that idea of like your neighbor next door, but also your neighbor kind of 10,000 miles away. So could you talk a little bit about how the Anthropocene or the concept of the Anthropocene has sort of shaped our perspective about kind of, for lack of a better term, taking care of one another, both locally and globally?
Yeah, I'd say it's been more of a challenge. I mean, when we talk about Anthropocene as an area of study, this has been one of the big challenges. Because the Anthropocene is describing these global processes, and so much of the emphasis has been on understanding how these global processes work. Often what you have had happen in the past was that the differentials and the different experiences weren't highly focused on in the Anthropocene literature. And there's a number of reasons for that, but the number one reason I would argue is because we're trying to find a global signature. Increasingly, I'd say about 10, 12 years ago, humanists and social scientists began really focusing in on this, again, asymmetrical Anthropocene and pointing out the inequities. And there's lots of different inequities. There's inequities that are caused by simply spatial differences, where you live on the planet. There's inequities around issues of gender. Inequities around issues of race and ethnicity. There's class inequities. All the historical inequities that we can describe also have an environmental component to it. And so I'd say maybe, over the last 10 or 12 years in particular, not that environmental scholars had not been focused on this before, but I'm talking about the Anthropocene discourse. You really see this come to the fore. And this is why humanists and artists and social scientists have become so much more involved in these conversations about the Anthropocene. This is why I'm involved. I'm a historian. This is why I'm involved in the discussions about the Anthropocene. Because what we're trying to do is understand the nuances of what the Anthropocene means for the lived experience. So when I started, I said, the Anthropocene is a concept and it's a lived experience. So this is that piece of that. How do people live the Anthropocene with each other? I think one of the really productive ways that people have been thinking about the Anthropocene has been in the context of environmental justice. Again, this is a longstanding movement that predates the Anthropocene, but has been really important in conversations around the Anthropocene. I also think there's a really interesting body of literature that tries to decenter, or I should say, remove the centeredness of the human in the Anthropocene and try to understand actually how all of the things on the planet experience the Anthropocene. This is the thing about the Anthropocene. It's not just experienced by humans. You know, it's experienced by animals, by plants, even by inanimate objects like rocks and things like this. These things are all experiencing the Anthropocene in severe ways at times, right? We are living through, as part of this Anthropocene, what some scholars have called the sixth great extinction. Throughout the history of the planet, there's, predating this, there's been five great extinctions. And the data seems to suggest that because of human-caused impacts on nature, that we are now living through a sixth great extinction. So this is one of the ways that the flora and the fauna are experiencing the Anthropocene, just like the humans around the planet. And so some scholars have said, let's focus on that as well. It's really important that we understand this other perspective, because it allows us to see our place in the world differently, and it allows us to think about how we act in the world differently.
You know, Jason, that really helps frame it, and it matches up with some other kinds of things. You know, it was really kind of also in the 1960s that we kind of began to break away as ecologists from just studying the natural world into studying urban environments and urbanization and where people were. And you start to see a really, right along that, right at that same time, you historically also see civil rights, you see human rights, you see the rights of animals and the environment. All that kind of rose in it's there before, but it kind of got its start in that 60s, 70s era. And so I think what you were saying is really, really important for people to understand. It was there, but we may not have been really studying it in any kind of in-depth way. And then all of a sudden we got to a point where we realized, wow, humans and the environment, they're somehow affecting one another and have a bigger impact than we thought about that. I've been talking to Jason Kelly, who's the founder and director of the IUPUI Arts and Humanities Institute, about the history of the Anthropocene. Please join us for more conversation after a short break.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. I'm Krista Longton, and today we're having a conversation with Dr. Jason M. Kelly about the importance of our rivers and streams, both historically and today. And as we were headed into the break, we were really having a conversation about the Anthropocene as a concept and really how the relationship between humans and the natural world. And so I know, Mark and Jason, you all collaborated on an event a couple of years ago that really had a focus or used rivers as a starting point to talk about the Anthropocene. So Jason, do you want to talk about the concept of rivers broadly and how that fits into this important concept as we know it today?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Yes, the conference you're referring to is this conference that we held here in Indianapolis in 2014 that we called Rivers of the Anthropocene. There's a couple of reasons we held that. You know, this idea began actually back in 2011. We were sitting down with our research partners in the UK, and we were trying to think of what are the ways that draw our cities together. And the city we were working with was Newcastle. And we're trying to figure out what are the two things that draw us together. And we thought about our rivers, actually, that, you know, the Tyne River is one of the great coal rivers of the 19th century, of course. And so we were thinking about the Ohio River, because we live in this Ohio River basin here, and thinking about the ways they compared. And this kind of began to balloon up, because what was happening is scholars were beginning to talk more and more about the Anthropocene and what this meant. And we began connecting the rivers to the Anthropocene. The great thing about the rivers as a concept was that it was very grounded. Most people understand what a river is. But rivers, what the ancients, said that, you never step in the same river twice, right? So you know what it is, but it's constantly moving. It's moving because it's connected to everything, right? The water systems we're looking at, the water we're drinking was once water somewhere on the opposite side of the planet, right? So these systems are deeply interconnected. So we thought, all right, we got this concept of rivers. We got this concept of the Anthropocene. Let's bring those two things together. They make a perfect match for each other. And let's deal with one of the great issues that we know we're going to be dealing with. We know effectively what the problems of the Anthropocene are, right? We know about things like pollution and climate change and things of this nature. What we're not so great at is solving those problems, right? We can measure them. We can even understand their histories, but we're not great at solving them. So what if we took a slightly different approach to thinking about rivers and the Anthropocene than a lot of folks had done before? Let's bring together the scientists, but let's bring them together with the social scientists and the humanists and the artists and the policymakers and the community members. And let's begin what we're calling a transdisciplinary conversation, a conversation that is emerging from the problem of the Anthropocene, where we can all bring our expertise together and work together to address this problem. And this is, for our work here at our institute, has been a driving way of thinking about the Anthropocene. You can understand the problem, and we have all the tools to do that, but to find solutions, you also need to understand the human piece of it. And sometimes the human piece of that is beliefs and practices and culture and day-to-day needs. All of these things come together. And so let's bring the experts in the natural world together with the experts of the lived experience, together with people making policy and together with folks who are like artists who are asking us new questions about what our assumptions are. And let's challenge each other to move in the same direction together. So that's really where this was coming from. And that's, of course, why Mark was a key participant in the conference, because we're trying to bring everybody together.
You know, Jason, I think what was really powerful in all that you were talking about with that and why is that idea that we as humans also need to be able to feel like we can do something. And often we're presented with science. COVID's a good example. Often we're presented with something that we know a lot about, or in case of COVID's case, we didn't know a lot about, but we knew certain things. But it's scary. And when we talk about our water, well, are we going to have enough? Is it safe enough for us to drink? Well, what's in our water? All those things. If we don't do what you're saying, if we don't bring together all the other sides of the coin of humans to play in that, then what we're doing is exactly what you're saying. We will create anxiety that can actually make us not move forward. And so I think you're absolutely, you hit the critical moment when you brought that conference together and you guys said that was important. Was let's see if we can find solutions together rather than just we know what there is, but not explore that further. So that was great.
And it was amazing. We brought together some of the, some of the best earth sciences scientists on the planet came to Indianapolis in the middle of, I don't know if you remember this in 2014, but we had this Arctic, what did they call it? The
polar vortex.
Polar vortex. And we brought these people in on some of the coldest days in Indianapolis and talked about water. And everyone was just so open to it because everyone was ready for this conversation, right? We have been collecting data on planetary change and been able to point to human-induced planetary change since easily the 1980s. You think of something like the ozone hole, right? You know, that's Earth system science at work. And we've known about this for decades. And, you know, the scientists were beginning to hit on this problem of, okay, so where do we go from here? And so everyone was ready to think about this and thinking about it both at the global level, but trying to bring that global level down to the city level, down to the lived daily experience, because of course there is something all of us can do on a micro level. Being that we live in a democracy, you know, we have agency to change our policymakers who are deciding what our environmental policies are going to be too. So, you know, talking about this and educating people about this and listening to what people have to say about their daily experience was a great way to kind of get people charged up about what they can do.
When you talk about an event like that, Jason, again, I think about, because I agree with you, and you know this, that much of my work involves, working in and with the community to ask research questions and to solve sometimes intractable problems. And the adage I use with my medical students is that no one person is going to be in a room, you know, by himself curing cancer, that it's got to be, related to human behavior. And we need to have art as a tool to understand those experiences in ways that physicians and scientists who maybe have not experienced it can't. So can you help the listeners sort of understand, like, what do we do at an event like that beyond just listen to people talk? How does having this common language and having these conversations actually lead to meaningful change?
Sure. That's a great question. And I would say that this tended more towards an academic conference, to be fair. But that's not all we did. That was the kickoff to what has now been, at this point, 7-8 years of projects, which include things that are really meant for non-academics to come together. One of my favorite ones I can think of was in 2017, we brought an artist here, and Mark, you probably remember Rebecca Allen when she came here. She's a painter based in New York. And we put on an exhibition of her artwork called Fjord, Glacier, River. It was artwork from a trip that she had made to Norway and had studied this glacier. And my favorite part of all of that was we brought her together with a biologist, and we invited community members, whoever wanted to show up, and we gave them drawing pads and colored pencils and all kinds of things. And we went out for a nature hike together. We walked along Pleasant Run, and people were drawing, and Rebecca was teaching them how to observe and draw nature. And the biologist was explaining what they were seeing and what they were experiencing. And people were writing poetry. We were encouraging people to write poetry and take Instagram photos. And at the end of this, everybody came together and we scanned all of these things on site and created a book together. It was actually an 80-page book of poems and drawings and Instagram photos. And while that seems so far removed from these global things that I'm talking about, this happened in the middle of a city, right? Most people don't, and this gets to Mark's point about urban ecology, most people don't think about the city as an environment. They don't think about the ecologies within a city. And just getting people out to see the rich diversity of their natural surroundings and getting people to start thinking about the way those things interact with their day-to-day lives, that's really the first thing. That's really the first step. Anybody becomes an environmentalist because of some abstract concept. They become an environmentalist because they've come in contact with something that's changed their lives. Maybe it was growing up near a little small group of trees when you grew up and going and running in the woods, or maybe it was going down to a little stream and finding insects and things under the rocks. These are the things that change the way people relate to their environments. And that those, I think, I would argue, those are the first steps towards education, towards action that people need to take.
One of the things I love about that, and I'll share, you know, that I do a fair amount of work around communication about science, particularly between faith communities and academic communities. And in some of my work that I've done with the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, they talk about some of the values that sort of science-minded folks and not science-minded folks, which I don't love that term, but share, right? So things like wonder, the idea of wonder for the natural world, right? That you don't need a science degree to sit in awe of the things that are around us and to react to that both in a logical and in an emotional way. And I think, again, when we think about solving problems, as you said, you know, you don't become an environmentalist, you know, because you, I suppose you can, right? You read an academic book, but you also experience something in the world. And so what I love about events like that and what the Da Vinci Pursuit does and many other great organizations is about sort of helping us think about the ways in which we experience the world in very similar ways, even though we might not do similar work or might not live in similar places. So that's a very cool story.
Yeah, it helps too, Jason, when you're talking about the power. I'm thinking of an artist at the center of something that way. And it, when you do that, it's an old way that science had of actually seeing more. You know, advent of photography got us, and instrumentation got us to move where maybe we don't have to see as much or look or spend time. And what I remember about that event was we had all kinds of people from all walks of life and all socioeconomic backgrounds engaging together in looking at the world as they sketched. And so they were calming down. Things began to come out because they weren't making a lot of noise. I mean, I think the art as a way of seeing was incredibly powerful.
I agree. And that's why if anybody's ever in a meeting with me and they're talking about a new project, it doesn't matter what project it is. It could be a humanities project. It could be a physical sciences project. I'm there and I'm saying, let's bring the artists in. Let's bring in people outside of your area of specialty, because they're just going to ask you questions that you're not ready for. And it is going to make your project better. It always makes your project better to have that kind of perspective.
That's really great. You know, one of the other things that I think about in this, and you've both mentioned it a little bit, but I really want to spend a little bit of time for us talking about the inequities of how the environment affects us and water issues. And so I will bring us back to that after we take a short break.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation with Dr. Jason Kelly about why we should care about our rivers and streams. He provides us a starting point for a series of conversations about water and the ways in which humans have had an impact, as well as the ways in which they can restore, repair, and protect our rivers. And as we headed into the break, Mark, you mentioned the relationship between thinking about these issues of water and social inequity. So I'm wondering maybe if that's a good starting point for us to come back in.
Yeah, Jason, you know, that inequity, it's not equal, as we know, across the planet, even in terms of where there is water. So historically and geologically, water isn't, when we're talking about fresh drinking water, is not ubiquitous. And so it gets really problematic when, and let me give you a way to maybe think about starting. Many of our listeners probably don't realize, but when someone grows something that's water intensive, the water is in that fruit or that seed that we ship somewhere else. And then the water is eaten, consumed, and it's a waste product, and the water goes somewhere else. So if we talk about a country that already doesn't have a lot of water, thinking of asking them to, as a way of economic stability, to grow things that take the water off of their land, that's a part of what the inequities that I'm thinking about.
Yeah, I think that's so important to think about in general, right? When we think about, maybe step back even bigger. Let's go back to the global scale here, right? We feel, especially here in Indiana, we're surrounded by water, right? Like it just, especially this time of year, we feel like the water is boundless. But when we look around the globe, only 3% of all the water on the planet is fresh water. And only about half of that 3% is accessible in any reasonable form. You know, the stuff that's not accessible might be in glaciers or something like that, right? So about 1.5% of all the water you see on the planet is fresh water. That is the thing that sustains all the life on this planet, right? And right now, humans are using about 1/2 of that. Just when you think about, scientists use the term biomass. You know, this is like all the plants and animals on the planet. 50% is going to one species, humans, right? We're taking 50% of that water. That's a huge problem, because if we think about the United States now, that percentage of water that we take, then 59% of that in this country goes to industry. 33% of that goes to agriculture, and 8% of that is domestic use. So you may think, for example, in your day-to-day, I take short showers, I conserve water around the house, and that's great, and it's really important. But your water consumption isn't just turning on your faucets. It's what Mark just talked about. It's eating the almonds. It's eating those avocados. Water-intensive crops that it can be quite damaging to the environments where they're planted. But it's not just that, right? So when we talk 59% going to industry, your clothing that you wear, the things that you buy, all of the materials that are constructed in order to ship those things to you around the globe, right? Those are the things that we do where we're consuming hundreds more gallons per day than we even think we're consuming as individuals. So I'm getting us a little off from the environmental justice thing for just a moment so I can get back to the environmental justice thing. If we're not paying attention to those things, we are extracting more from our environments than we think that we are. And it's only by becoming self-reflective about that we're actually going to solve those water inequities, for example. We need to understand what we're doing in order to fix those. And the systems that are set up around us, the advertising, the ease of access, are doing everything they possibly can to force us, or to encourage us perhaps, to ignore all of those things that I was just talking about. And that comes at the expense of people around the globe. I'll point to one example. Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam, right? The city, the surface water in the city has been polluted because of the fast fashion industry, right? The production of cheap clothing for H&M or whatever place you buy your fast fashion at, the dyes and the production of these things have basically helped undermine the quality of the surface water in that area. So a lot of folks have put wells in to extract fresh water from the aquifers. Well, what that has been doing is, as people are trying to get fresh water, they're actually creating a suction, and they're pulling in salt water through the ground into those aquifers. And what's happening, and this isn't just in this place, this is happening in a lot of places, but as you extract the fresh water near the sea, salt water is coming in, and those aquifers are not going to be freshwater aquifers any longer. And so when you think about putting on that t-shirt that you got for $5, you know, these are some of the effects of that where you can't see those effects happening. So that begins to get us into a conversation about the global nature of environmental justice, because it's so easy, it's so hard for us to see what our footprint is, that it's easy for us to ignore those inequities around the globe.
That really, when we think about how that works its way through, and you start thinking then about populations that already are challenged with water. But it's beginning to hit home in places where we wouldn't have thought. Remember, it wasn't very long ago, 2 years ago, that a major city in Australia was wondering if they would have enough water for the city. Yeah. And it's a wealthy place. Yes, there's poverty there, but it wasn't an impoverished country, or it wasn't something that we might think about where there were all the factories you're talking about. It just literally was an overabundance of use in all the ways you're talking about. And in Indiana, we're thinking of putting Indianapolis area, another reservoir. Why? Because we are consuming water at a phenomenal rate in industry, not just agriculture, but now industry on top of it to track people. So it does become, you're exactly right, we start using the resources of the world, disproportionately.
Yeah. And it's actually, Indianapolis is a pretty, or I'd say, let's say Indiana is a really interesting place to think about this, right? In a place like Indianapolis and the donut counties around us, we have the sprawling city, right? The urban density is extremely low here in central Indiana. And so we're paving over large portions. And what we're not paving over of the city, we're planting grass, non-native species here that are water intensive during the summer, right? So, and then what we have in America is this aesthetic of the green lawn, right? This is an aesthetic that was popularized, especially in the wake of World War II, right? With the suburbanization of America, the greening of the lawns, this was a signifier that you've made it to the middle class, right? You have this beautiful green lawn. Well, we've so internalized that here in the United States, we have these green lawns everywhere. And what they require is insane, right? We require huge amounts of water to keep them green in the summer. Then, of course, many people put fertilizers across those to make them even greener. And of course, they also put herbicides all over those, so the other plants can't grow up in between to make their green grass yellow with dandelions or purple with other things that are growing in it. And what happens is we have this huge amounts of water that drop here from time to time and wash all of this extra fertilizer out into our streets, which of course are not permeable, wash them right into our drainage system, which we all know where that goes, right out into our river systems here, which I said before flows into the Ohio River, which eventually finds its way down the Mississippi River. And what we see at the end of the Mississippi, we see all of those, let's just say fertilizers, all coming together in one place. Indiana is one of the largest contributors to phosphorus and nitrogen in the Gulf. So if people in Louisiana are experiencing the consequences of our agriculture, yes, of course, but also our greening of our lawns. And what has happened is when you get too much nitrogen or fertilizer, too much fertilizer in the water, which washes out into the Gulf of Mexico, what you get are things like algae blooms. You see huge amounts of green growing, and then all of a sudden, it can't grow any longer because it sucked up all of the oxygen in the water, and then it dies off. And all of those animals that were living off of that green stuff, who were in that area, also lose all the oxygen in the water as things die. And what you create are what are called dead zones. Sometimes, you know, massive areas of dead zone where nothing can live. Of course, that affects people who fish down in Louisiana. It affects the day-to-day lives of people who are trying to get by doing their jobs. We up here can benefit from things like green lawns. I bring this up to point out that it's hard to see the consequences of our actions unless we step back a little bit and start to see the long effects of our actions, because things are hidden very easily.
Right, and it's almost sometimes that they're designed to be hidden from us. Yeah. This is just an incredible discussion and a great start to what we want to have as a series. I want to thank you, Jason, so much for being with us and helping us to kind of frame that discussion. And I'm looking forward to having more discussions with other people as well as you as we move forward with looking at water and our rivers and streams.
Well, thanks, Mark. And Krista, this has been a really wonderful conversation. I appreciate you having me here. I think there's a lot more to be said, especially about environmental justice and water.
I agree.
Thanks again, Jason. Until next time, I'm Krista Longton, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.